This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. To mark the 40th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion and Massacre and address current prison struggles 40 years ago, September 9, 1971, inmates in New York's Attica prison began a protest against jail conditions that ended on September 13th as one of the bloodiest days in the 20th century in the U.S. Troopers shot indiscriminately over 2,000 rounds of ammunition, and 29 prisoners and 10 state personnel would die. After the shooting stopped, the police beat and tortured scores of prisoners. 90 of the surviving prisoners were seriously wounded, but were initially denied medical care.
The state would originally claim that all the guards had died at the hands of the inmates. The New York Times reported on its front page that the throats of all the guards were slashed, but it was lies. The guards, as well as the prisoners who were deemed expendable, had been shot dead during the raid. The Attica Uprising is an under-commemorated historical event. Millions watched the drama from interviews with inmate leadership all the way to the climactic helicopter gunship assault, which was as ruthless and one-sided as anything coming out of Vietnam. While the legacy of the Attica Uprising includes the establishment of prisoner legal services and the Prisoners' Rights Project, it also includes the Rockefeller drug laws.
Of course, all of this is against the backdrop and reality that we have removed from our communities today more than 2 million people who are incarcerated. And we have 65 million people in total who were in some way under the control and auspices of the prison industrial complex. We're going to hear how critical in terms of moral and political imperative it is to deal with the new Jim Crow through Attica is all of us, the stirring event that commemorated 40 years of the Attica Uprising at Riverside Church, and we're going to listen to Daruba Bin Wahad, and after that, Cornel West.
This is very important. I hope that we can use this particular forum to build a movement in this city for the abolishment of prisons that we hold. Now, many of you know that there's a plaque in Attica. And on this plaque are the names of the state officials, the guards who were brutally murdered by the state of New York. There are no names of any of the Attica brothers or prisoners who were slain in that deal. This speaks to the inhumanity that continues when it comes to our history and our experiences. We are not counted as human beings. In fact, race in America is still a dangling conversation, an incompleted dialogue. And it was at the root of what happened in Attica on those fateful days in September. Racism, institutional, social racism, was at the root of the dehumanization of every human being in that yard. And so what I want to say, and what's very important, is that we understand that it is our duty in this particular place, at this particular time, to build alternatives to prisons as we know. It is our obligation to abolish prisons, not reform, and build caring communities that will nourish our people and help our people and empower working people. So I want to say that when we say Attica is all of us, we have to understand that in this city of New York, the tracking of black males began in the 1950s with the constructions of projects, with the building of special schools, 611 schools. The tracking of young black men in this city began at the height of the Cold War and continue uninterrupted until that moment in the D-Yard. Every brother in that yard came from only 6 communities in the entire state of New York. To this day, the distribution of prisoners to the prison system still remains the same. The vast majority of prisoners in the state of New York come from only a few communities in the entire state. And those communities are black, they're poor, they're marginalized, and they're disenfranchised. We have to understand that mass incarceration today began with urban renewal yesterday. It began with the projects that were put up in the South Bronx, when landlords, absentee landlords, used to burn their houses, burn tenements, and collect the money and leave. The South Bronx was devastated. Brownsville was devastated. In this city, black and Latinos have suffered marginalization, criminalization, and racial profiling for the past 50 plus years. It's time to bring this type of system down on its knees. It's time for us to build a new society, a new way of dealing with people in our community who need help, who need jobs, and who need to be respected as human beings. And so I say to the brothers, who were traumatized by the brutality and murder in that D-yard and have survived to this day. Some have spent 44 years in prison. 44 years in prison. 48. 2 lifetimes. Some of us in here aren't even 48 years old. We have to understand that a system that warehouses and locks up human beings cannot be the solution to social ill in this society. We have to understand that the containment of African people in the urban areas today is a result of a social process that began yesterday. We have to empower our people. We have to understand that 65 million people in the United States with criminal convictions. 65 million. People who cannot get a job because they have a criminal record. We have 2.3 million people in prison who are not even recognized as workers. But they perform the task of corporations that are run by the corrections department. Every prison in the state of New York, there are 5 to 6 correctional personnel who maintain the records, who maintain the correctional facility, and who draws a paycheck off of the flesh and blood of poor black people, of poor Latinos, of working class people who cannot get jobs, but who can suffer under the boot heel of a police state. Brothers and sisters, it's time for us to organize. It's time for us to build a movement that abolishes prison and builds compassionate communities. And I hope that this dialogue here will inspire everyone here to sign up for the projects that we're going to be carrying forward from this point on. The projects to empower the powerless in this society, to recognize the undocumented, to change the paradigm of dehumanization of people who have made a mistake in their life. So I say I'm honored to be here with this distinguished panel to share our thoughts on this, and I hope that you will go away from here endowed and fired up to begin to build a new constituency in this country, an anti-war constituency, an anti-imprisonment constituency, that we change our perspective and build caring communities. Thank you.
Resilient resistance. See the brothers and sisters on the corner watch 1965 in Detroit, the 67 in Newark in 67, and 212 rebellions tonight. Brother Martin Luther King was shot down like a dog 1 year after he gave his Beyond Vietnam speech to bring poor people together, bring a critique to bear on the viciousness of American imperialism. That's what we're talking about here. That's what we're talking about. against the historical backdrop of a people who have been so terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized that we have been taught to be scared, intimidated, always afraid, distrustful of one another, and disrespectful of one another. But the Atticus Rebellion was a countermove in that direction. I call it the niggerization of a people, not just black people, because America has been niggerized since 9/11. Niggerized, unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, hated for who you are. You become so scared that you defer to the powers that be, and you're willing to consent to your own domination.
If you're not talking about the criminal activity on Wall Street and that one person Sad thing is the kind of courage that these brothers had in 1971 is in short supply. It's in short supply. Because when you bring together the national security state and military industrial complex, when you bring together the prison industrial complex and all the profits that flow from it, when you bring together a corporate media multiplex that don't want to allow for serious dialogue, unless we got Sister Amy or Brother Tavis or somebody. And then when you bring together the Wall Street oligarchs and the Pluto, the corporate plutocrats, and they tell any person or any group, if you speak the truth, we'll shoot you down like a dog and dehumanize you the way we typically humanize the brothers and addicts. The only thing that will keep you going, you better have some love in your heart for people. That's the only thing that will keep you going. The only reason why it's a long-distance runner to go. The only reason why Barack is a long-distance runner. I don't care if you agree with him ideologically or not. It doesn't make any difference. They got enough love for the people in their heart to still tell the truth about poverty, about suffering, about struggle, and be able to look not just presidents, but by presidents, you're just talking about the placeholder of the oligarchs and the plutocrats. I don't care what color they are. To tell that truth. They hold off on that. I said, no, I got one life. I saw what they did. I filled it up. We're going to have a new wave. We're going to have a new wave of truth telling. We're going to have a new wave of witness bearing. And we're going to teach the younger generation that these brothers didn't struggle in vain, just like John Brown and Nat Turner and Marcus Garvey and Martin King and Miles Fulton and the other city. And we shall see what happens. We might get crushed too. But you know what? Then you just go down swinging like Ella Fitzgerald Muhammad Ali.
My dear brother friends, he shows deep love and I embrace it. He is the artistic genius in our midst. He is a musical artist among us. Raise your Socratic questions to the system. Bear witness to justice against the system. Be true to who you are and be true to the grand vision. Keep track of the least of these. Break it down, Brother Smith. What's wrong with the world today? Things got to be better.
You've been listening to in the background. You can hear Prince and Cornel West and the presentations of Daruba Bin Wahad and Cornel West were completely awesome at the Attica is All of Us event that took place on the 40th anniversary of the Attica uprising. We're going to go back now and listen to one of the major organizers now in the prisoners' rights movement, Jazz Haydn, in the new movement, really, against Jim Crow, Jazz Haydn.
On September 13th, 2000, I was released from prison. Now, I filed a class action lawsuit in commemoration of the brothers that died in Attica. I filed a class action lawsuit challenging the denial of the right to vote to prisoners. Prisoners, parolees, and the communities they come from were class members of this class action lawsuit. And how I arrived at filing this lawsuit was the result in 1993 of some findings that were made by a think tank that I had pulled together. And we began to research the whole history of prisons. And we brought it all the way back up to 1993. And when we got back to 1993, we realized one of the findings was that prison administrators
had 100% of power and prisoners had zero. So that was something I wasn't comfortable with, and the members of the think tank wasn't comfortable with either. So there were other findings as a result of our research, and one of those findings was that prisoners in four states in the United States voted from their prison cells. Can you imagine finding that out? You know, after realizing that we had 0% of power. So when we begin to look at these states, Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Utah, well, they're citizens of the United States and we're citizens of the United States. How is it that they have the right to vote from their prison cells, but we don't have the right to vote? So naturally, the next step was lawsuits. There was another group in Green Haven Prison that was also doing the same research because it was the idea of time had come. And they raced ahead and they managed to hook up with a law school. They began doing research all around the country. And my group in Eastern were doing research all around the country and we'd be bumping into one another. But because they had some law professors in law school with them, they ended up filing their complaint. And they filed it, and they lost. I think they lost in the district court. So the next step was the Eastern group, my group, to begin to make steps towards filing this class action lawsuit. But we didn't want to jump out there pro se. So I reached out to every civil rights organization in the country, all of them. NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, NAACP, Urban League. It's been, this was in 1993, so don't mind me if I don't remember all the rest of it, but we reached out to all of them. And we still have letters, I still have the letters in response that said, well, we ain't got time for that right now, or we fighting to get this flag off the state building in Okeechobee, New York. Somewhere, but nobody offered to represent prisoners in this class action lawsuit. So finally, as I was beginning of reaching the point where I was getting ready to leave, on September 13th, 2000, I filed this class action lawsuit pro se. Me and some of the brothers in the law library sat down together and pulled this together. And then when we got out, I got out. They had the election in Florida, the presidential election, George Bush and Vice President Al Gore. And because of an issue that developed in Florida with them removing people from the voting eligibility list because they had the same names as people that had been disenfranchised, you know, and the number of people that were denied the right to vote in Florida affected the outcome of that election, right? Suddenly now, felon disenfranchisement becomes the issue. The funders are pouring money into it. The advocacy organizations, man, are rushing to get that money. And in less than 2 weeks, I had three law firms. I had three law firms. And then those three law firms were the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Magna Evers Center for Law and Justice, and Community Service Society, a law firm. And we went to war. And we went to war, and this war went on for 6-7 years. And ultimately, we had a hearing in the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit here, right in Manhattan. The courtroom was filled, just like this audience is here today. And we had amicus briefs filed by law firms all over the country in support of our position in our class action lawsuit. And the court questioned us and questioned the U.S. Attorney's Office, and everything looked great. And then the decision came back. The court split down the middle, 5-5, and therefore their ruling had no precedential value. So prisoners continue not to be able to vote. And the impact of this is what is really at issue here. The Because every time they take a busload of prisoners from Harlem, they take a busload of votes. Every time they take a busload of prisoners from Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brownsville, East New York, Lower East Side, they're taking a busload of votes. And at one time in this state here, they had over 70,000 prisoners that were denied the right to vote. And another 50, 60, 70,000 on parole that couldn't vote, right? So our communities reflected this. They reflected this state of powerlessness that resulted as a result of having their community members locked up in these cages and stripped of the fundamental right in democracy, which is the right to vote. This is another democracy if you can't vote. You understand? That is the fundamental right. This is reduced to a question of power. Because the reason that prison population expanded from 300,000 to 2.3 million and another 5 or 6 million under the control of the criminal justice system was a pushback against the gains of the civil rights struggle.
You're listening to Jazz Hayden at the Attica Is All of Us event. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.